Okay. Parshas Noach. Parshas Noach. I want to talk a little bit about the Dor HaFloga, the Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babel, which is, you know, a story that's so familiar to us that we sometimes forget to look at it again. Now, it's remarkable, you have the sheets in front of you, so you know the answer, but do a test. Go and ask, you know, an otherwise knowledgeable shulgoer who probably hasn't thought about Parshas Noach since last Parshas Noach, and ask them, how many psukim does the Torah spend on the story of the Mabul, and how many psukim does the story spend on the story of the Migdal Bavel? It's remarkable. The story of the Mabul is spread over four long prakim. The Migdal Bavel is contained in 9 psukim. Now, I remember being a child going to Hebrew school and being taught the Bible stories about Bereshit and Noah and the Ark and the Tower of Babel, etc. The Migdal Bavel is always presented as the follow-up story to the flood. These two stories of two different generations, even in Chazal, I mean, the Torah doesn't call it this. It's Chazal that call it the Dor HaMabul and the Dor HaFloga, the generation of the flood and the generation of the dispersion. And the very language to refer to these two incidences by the names of their generations sets up this comparison and this contrast. And that's the way we always think about it. Mm-hmm. I won't read through that. The psukim themselves, I trust, are well known enough to everybody. If not, do a quick scan of the psukim. I mean, beyond Vayihi Kol Haaretz, Safa Achat Udvarim Achadim. Safa Achat Udvarim Achadim. That the entire land was one language and one davar. One word, one thing, one purpose. Rashi says, Ba'u be'etza achat. This group of people came with one scheme. And then Rashi tells us what the sin of the generation was. Because it's not perfectly clear in the Torah what their sin was. It's not perfectly clear at all. How do I know it's not perfectly clear? Because Rashi has to give us 3 different possibilities of what these folks did wrong. If it was perfectly clear, we would know it. So Rashi gives us 3 possibilities of what their sin was. The Midrashim, the Gemara, the other Mifreshim, pile on a number of others, and depending upon how you look at what it is that they were doing that was so wrong, will help you understand what's going on in the story, and whether or not this kind of notion that we have, that the Dor HaMabul is the Dor HaFloga, the story of the Migdal Bavel is the appendix to the story of the flood, is correct or not. Rashi says, Dvarim achadim bo beitz achad v'amru lo hemenu shibo lo et ha'elyonim. Na'le l'rakia v'nase emanu milchama. The first analysis of their fault is that they made some kind of claim against God. Said it's not fair that he should live upstairs in the penthouse and we should be stuck down here on earth. It's not fair that he should be up and we should be down. Let's go up to the heavens. And we'll fight a war with him. Davar acher, a second interpretation, al yichido shel olam. They made some type of claim against the one, the echad, Hashem echad. In other words, apparently, the building the tower was some type of attack on the idea of Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, that God is one. That God is one. And the idea that there should be a tower, a very tall building, whether it literally could reach heaven, or Virosho Bashamayim means, you know, a really tall building, a skyscraper doesn't actually scrape the sky. It's a metaphor. It means really, really tall. is maybe it was a temple of Avodah Zarah that was coming to contrast against this, in their idea, mistaken notion of Hashem Echad. Davar Acher, third idea in Rashi, Dvarim Achadim, or there's a different version of Rashi, Dvarim Chadim. They said certain words, they said certain sharp words, chad, sharp, piercing words. Amru, achat le'elef v'sheish mod v'chamishim v'sheish shanim, once every 1,656 years, harakia mitmotet. The heavens crumble. They were afraid that there would be another flood. And they said, look, from the time of the creation of the world until Noah, there was 1,656 years. And that period is coming up again, and maybe there'll be another flood. Now this is very interesting, because the idea that things happen from time to time, in other words, you hang around long enough, you realize that once every 365 days or so, the seasons have come full circle. You hang around long enough, you look up at the sky, you realize once every 29, 30 days, the moon goes from being full to being full again. Waxes and wanes in a cycle of 30 days. But you have to observe this a couple of times to notice that there's some kind of cycle going on. There's no cycle yet. There was 1,656 years since the creation of the world. There was a flood, Noah, the ark, the animals. We read the stories. Now it's been another period of 1,656 years, and they're afraid that there's going to be another flood. So the idea is that they're going to build the Migdal, and it's going to be a support on the heavens. Right. Or, Rashi has this idea, we'll see later on, there's this idea that not that it supports the heavens, but we're going to go up there, and we're going to fix it so that the water can't come down. We'll knock holes in it, and the water will drip down. We'll empty up. There must be a reservoir of water up there. We'll bring it down, tipa, tipa, and then there won't be a flood. Three ideas in Rashi for what's going on here. But Rashi, at least in the third answer, is again making this connection between this story and the previous story of the flood. A few other highlights in Rashi, in Pasuk Beis, Vayhi ben As'am Mikedem, V'nasu misham latur lahem makom lahachzik et kulam. That this place, Shinar, where they build the tower, this group of people, whether it was literally all of the people, the entire population of the known world, or it was just like a really large group, they travel from Kedem, from the east, and they're looking for a place to settle that can hold them all. They wanted one place that they could all live together. V'lo matzu ela b'shinar. Pasuk Vav, hein am echad v'secha achat. Right? And Pasuk Vav says, Vayomer Hashem says, this is not good what they're doing. They're trying to build this tower. Vayomer Hashem, hein am echad v'secha achat l'kulam, v'ze hachilam la'asot, v'ata lo yivatzer mehem. I shouldn't stop them. They have one language. They have unity. They're one nation. They have one language, and they're doing this. They're fighting against me. They're rebelling. Whatever it is, according to whatever interpretation you choose, they're doing something negative. What? I'm not going to stop them. So Rashi says, "Hein am echad u'safa achat kol tuva zu yeshimahem." They have all the best things. A nation, one nation, under God. Indivisible, but they, what do? They're under God, but they reject God. Right? Kol tuva yesh imahem. They have everything. Everything being am echad, safa echad. One language, one culture, one nation. And b'chol zot, in all cases, sh'am echad hem safa echad l'kulam v'davar zeh echelu lasot. And they're doing this. In other words, it's not like they have troubles. It's not like they have bad things. They have good things. What are the good things? That they have this unity. That they have this unity. That they have this unity. And this unity, the last Rashi in Pasuk Tet, Rashi says, again, making the link between the Migdal Bavel and the Mabul,
Eze kashe, shodor ha-mabul or shodor ha-flaga. Everybody knows this Rashi. Which was worse? Whose sin was worse? The generation of the flood or the generation of the tower? Elu lo pashtu yad b'ikar. V'elu pashtu yad b'ikar. Kiveyochal leilachem bo. The generation of the flood didn't reject God. But these people, the folks of the Migdal Bavel, they pashtu yad b'ikar, they are rejecting God. However, whichever interpretation you choose, and they, as it were, try to fight against Hashem, v'elu nishtefu, but nevertheless, the generation of the flood were wiped out. They all died except for the eight people in the ark and all those animals. V'elu lo ne'ebdu min ha'olam. But nevertheless, the sin of the Migdal Bavel, the generation of Migdal Bavel, whose sin, lichora, was worse, they weren't killed, they weren't wiped out. Why? Ela shedor ha'mabul hayu gazlanim v'haytam riva b'neihem l'kach ne'ebdu. What was the sin of the generation of the flood? They were thieves, they were mean to each other, they treated each other improperly, and that's why they were wiped out. V'elu, but the sin, the generation of the Migdal Bavel, despite the fact that they were apikorsim, they tried to fight a war against Hashem, elu hayu noagim ahava v'reut b'neihem. But they had unity, they had brotherhood, they had love. Shnemar safa achat u'dvarim achadim. L'marta shesanui hamachloket v'gadol hashalom. And this shows you the power of unity, of love, of brotherhood, of peace, of tranquility. Because these people who were united to do bad things, but nevertheless, that unity is still somehow considered a merit to them. But the generation of the flood, whose sin was, at least on paper, less severe, looking at it objectively, they did not have unity. And therefore, they didn't even have that one merit. So Rashi reads the story very much opposed to the story that comes before it. The Migdal Bavel is compared to the Dor HaMabul. The generation of the dispersion is compared to the generation of the flood. There's an earlier Rashi. When Hashem's saying we're going to mix up their languages. Their punishment is, of course, that they're dispersed, and their languages are mixed up. Instead of all speaking one language, they now start to speak different languages. So Rashi says that lo yishmu'u, they won't be able to hear each other, they won't be able to listen to each other. Ze sho'el levena, v'ze mevitit. So they're trying to build, and as Rashi's explaining, it's like a technical punishment, the fact that their languages are all mixed up, that now you're going to speak one language, I'm going to speak another language, you're going to speak a third language, we can't communicate. So this project, this huge national project of building a tower that can reach the heavens, technically it won't work. Why? Because I'm going to ask for a hammer, and you're going to hand me a brick. Or no, I'm going to ask for a brick, and you're going to hand me the cement. Right? Because we won't have the same words for anything. So what's going to happen? So when you hand me the wrong thing, I'm going to take a hammer and bash in your head. So because we're all going to be busy bashing in each other's heads, Rashi says, we're not going to meet our deadline, right? You know, I guess it's like the way Kablanim work. Right? That you can't get the job done in time because everybody's busy not sitting drinking the coffee, but they're busy bashing each other's heads in. Right? So this is a strange thing. Why would that be? I was the other day here, davening Mincha, and there was a fellow outside who asked me, parlez-vous français, which is as much French as I speak. So I had to say, no. But I was able to say it with, that's the extent of my high school French. Right? But I think he needed, the best I could understand was, he needed directions how to get someplace. So he came in, he davened Mincha, and he asked around, even though there are a lot of French speakers here, so much so that the announcements from the shul, they send it out in Hebrew, in English, and in French. But there was nobody at Mincha who spoke French. So this poor fellow, who apparently didn't speak any of the other languages, he was stuck. So I felt bad for him. I wanted to help him. I wanted to say, that guy, he speaks French. I didn't have a havamina to take a hammer and bash in his head. The fact that we couldn't communicate means that we can't give up. Why would I, if I ask for the brick and you give me the mortar, so like I'm going to have to point for the brick. Like, where does this idea come from that it's going to automatically lead to homicide? That's a question that we have to resolve. If you turn the page, to page 2, this question of what they were up to, what they were trying to do, is an interesting one. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuftet says, "Dor hafloga ein lahem chelik l'olam haba." That's a Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, in Perek Chelik. "My Ovid." What did they do? What was their sin? So Omri debei Rabbi Sheila, Nivne Migdal v'nale l'rakia v'nake oto b'kardumot. This is what the idea I was referring to a minute ago. It's not exactly what Rashi was saying. As Rashi says, they're going to build like a scaffold to hold up the heavens. So the Gemara, Rabbi Sheila, said, no, they're going to build a tower, they're going to get up to Shamayim, literally, and they're going to take axes and hammers and tools, and they're going to knock it up. Kadesh yazovu meimav, so that all the mayim should trickle down. This is what I mentioned a moment ago. So that it can't all come down in one flood and get us again, even though Hashem had promised that he would never do that again. They didn't believe the promise. They're going to go and they're going to make an insurance policy against any subsequent flood. So this idea in the Gemara, I don't know whether Reb Sheila thought that this is what they were trying to do, meaning this is what they might have done had they not been stopped, or this is what they thought they were going to do. In other words, that's an interesting question. Did they literally think that they could build a tower and get to Shamayim being what? Not the stratosphere, but the residence of God. You know, like kids think, like up there on a cloud, there's a palace, there's a castle, and in there is Hashem. This is an idea that children have to be disabused of. Right? But it's like this idea that there's heaven, there's earth, he's up there, he's not up there, he's not down here, he's no place in the sense that he's every place. He doesn't have any physical, corporeal properties, but this is like a notion. So did the Dor HaFluga, did they really think that they could get up there? This is a question. Right? And it's, first of all, did they think that they could literally get there? And the Mephorshim that are trying to explain their position, are they saying this is what they, or are there Mephorshim that think that, like, there's a way to get to the heavens? So it's an important question. If the Dor HaFluga thought they could literally get to the heavens, so we know that they can't. Like, we know it's an impossible task. Even if in outer space, Lu Yitzur, it's not true. But Lu Yitzur, they thought that there's like a palace in heaven and God lives there, and if we can only get there, we can fight against him. Right? So they wouldn't have been able to reach that place. And we can't do it. In the 21st century, we can't do it. We don't have the technology to do it. They certainly couldn't do it. Right? So what does Hashem have to come and stop them for and punish them? Lefech, let them fuck Hashem. You want to do it? Do it. Start building your tower. Build it as tall as you want. Sooner or later, they're not going to get any place. Sooner or later, they're going to run out of bricks or run out of the raw materials to build the bricks, because you can't build a tower that high. Certainly not in the pre-modern era, where they don't know about digging a foundation to build a tower. That's why you had to build, like the pyramids, which are really pretty tall for an ancient building. They had to have a very wide base to get that tall. Even so, they can only get so tall. They can only get so tall. So why doesn't Hashem just let them keep building? And sooner or later, they're going to get tired of it, and they're going to stop doing it. So many Mephorshim think that the Dor HaFluga themselves didn't think they could literally get to heaven. But that Migdal V'Rosh HaBashamayim is a metaphor for a really, really tall building, the tallest building that they could make. And that's these other answers that the Gemara says. The Gemara says about this idea that they thought they literally could get to heaven. In Eretz Yisrael, they laughed at that notion. They laughed at this Babylonian, the Amoraim Bavlim had this idea that the Dor HaFluga thought they could literally get to heaven. So they said, no, it can't be that they thought that. Right? Im kein, livnu echad b'turah. So first of all, they say the Torah itself indicates that they didn't literally think they could get to heaven. Because where do they start building the Migdal? In a valley, in a bika. Right? That's the pesukim. V'imtzu bika be'eretz shinar v'yashvu sham. They're living in a valley. So if I want to build a tower that's going to literally get to the heaven, where am I going to build it? I'm going to build it on a mountain that's going to give me, you know, 1,000 meters elevation above sea level head start. But they're building it in a low place, in a valley. So it's obvious, the very fact that they chose to build it there shows that they didn't think they could literally get to heaven, but that they were building a tall tower. And then the Gemara tries to explain exactly, you know, why they were building the tower, what the tower was. It was a symbol of Avodah Zarah, it was a symbol of this, it was meant to be one thing or another. Interestingly, Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, has a comment. So this is something that I've long heard about, but I never saw it, and I found it in honor of the Shir. And on the website, if you dance, not on the Makarot that you have, but if you go to the website and download the Makarot, there's some supplemental things there. Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz has a work called the Tiferet Yehonatan. It's a work on Chumash. And he asks the following question. He says, it doesn't make sense. Why did they want this tower? The Torah says, V'hava nivna posuk dalet, hava nivna lanu iru, migdal v'rosho b'shamayim. We're going to build a city with a tower whose top is in heaven. V'nase lanu shem, pen nafutz al pnei kol ha'aretz. Lest we be dispersed around the entire earth. So Yonasan Eibschitz says, in the pre-modern era, in order to build the taller the building was, the wider the base had to be to support it. Right? It's not like our skyscrapers, where the footprint of the building, right, is the same size as the top of the building. Sometimes they have like a little tower on top for direction. But think of Zichronam Levracha, the Twin Towers. They were squares that just went up really high. The footprint of the top floor was identical to that on the bottom floor, because that's what modern architecture can do. But in the pre-modern world, the taller the building, the wider the base. So if you were going to build something that literally was going to get to heaven, the base would have had to be so wide that the people that lived on the east would be so far removed from the people that lived on the west that mimela they would be dispersed around the entire earth. And if the purpose of the Migdal was to bring them all together so that they wouldn't be dispersed, it's self-defeating. So he says the following thing. He says the Migdal, it wasn't that tall. It was like a hollow tube, a kaneh, right? And it was filled with what he calls avkat srefa, which I think means gunpowder. And on top of this hollow tower was a sfina, and they would ignite it, and the sfina would shoot up to heaven, and it would get to the moon. It was an escape hatch. In other words, it was like Tevat Noach 2. Instead of building a boat, because they were afraid there was going to be another flood, it was an escape capsule to get to the moon. He says, because maybe we can live on the moon, right? Now, he's writing this 50 years before Jules Verne, right? He's writing this 150 years before Jules Verne, this is what he says. It's a remarkable thing, but most Mefarshim do not present such fantastical interpretations as Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz does, right? As Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz does. So if they were building a building that really wasn't going to be Bashamayim, it was just going to be a tall building with a reasonable base to keep everybody united, so then what's the problem? If not like Rashi. So the Netziv, this you have on page 3, the Netziv, Ravinder always tells us, the Netziv is worthy of our attention, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, the end of the 19th century, turns his attention to Pashanut HaMikra and creates a very innovative interpretation on the Chumash. So the Netziv says the following things. Look at Pasuk Aleph in the Netziv, Safachat, from the end of the first line. V'zehu, this idea that they would live b'kibbutz echad, that they would live in one place, that all of the peoples of the earth would live in one place, zehu neged ritzon Hashem, this is against God's will. Sh'amar, shertzu ba'aretz, ruba, haynu lehitalech l'arka l'rachva, ki l'shevet yatzra. So the very idea that they should all live together, that they should all live in one place, is against God's will. God created the world. He wanted the people to populate it. Right? I was talking about this with my son. I have a relatively young son, 12 years old, and I asked him this question. I said, well, what was if they couldn't really get up to heaven? So what's the big deal? Right. Now, we have a little baby at home. So the baby has one of these play kitchen things, like one of these toys, plastic toys that look like a stove and look like a pot, things like that. So when the kid is like playing with the stove and he turns the dial and it makes the clicking noise, like when you're turning on the fire, let him play all day. But oy vey, he would actually go to the stove and try to turn it on. We'd stop him right away. So why don't we try to stop him when he's playing with the toy stove? Because he can't hurt himself. He can play with it all day long, from today until tomorrow. It'll never start a fire. So the Migdal Bavel is like the toy stove. They could build and build and build and build. They're never going to get to heaven, so why does Hashem have to stop them? Right? So my son said something very interesting, which is basically what the Netziv is saying. Also the Ran says something. Somebody says, because, like, you know, you have to do things. Like, if the whole world would be busy trying to, it would take the whole world, the manpower of the whole world, to build such a thing. Right? So everybody would starve to death. They wouldn't, right? Nobody would be farming. Nobody would be raising sheep and cattle and making hamburgers and other things. And that's not what Hashem wants. Hashem wants us to get out there and do it. So he said in his own language, you know, what the Netziv says telegraphically. Dvarim Achadim, from like the third line, Delo Mishum HaDvarim Hitorer HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It wasn't the content of what these folks were saying. Ki Im B'Shvil Shehayu Achadim. It's not what they were saying. Again, the Netziv is walking a very different line than how Rashi painted it. It's not what they were saying. It's like your mother used to say, or my mother used to say. It's not what you say, but how you say it. It's not what they were saying, the content, but the fact that they were Dvarim Achadim. There was one party line. Yiyu ma shiyu. V'davar zeh, imki, l'fi hanireh, ein bezeh shum avon. There's no inherent sin in this idea that we're going to build a very tall tower. V'adarabah, chibur atzavim gam kein roi laniach. On the contrary, unity of purpose is generally a good thing. Aval kan, but in this case, garam lachshov davar shiyatza l'takala, l'takalat ishvoka asher yivuar. But their unity of purpose was directed towards something very negative. What was so negative? So he's going to go on to explain. It's not like Rashi. Go skip down to Pasuk Dalet. V'roshov b'shamayim, the top of the tower gets to heaven. Zev vaday lo yalal adat sheyir achat l'kol ha'olam, ela kisvurim sheyu kol ha'arim smuchim smuchot utfelot l'oto ha'ir. So he says, obviously it's not meant to be taken literally that there'd be only one city for the whole world, that the entire population of the world would fit into one city. But what? That there'd be a capital. There'd be one place and all of the surrounding cities and villages would be subservient, would be ruled from that one central capital. V'yeh ha-migdal v'tzapot mimenu l'merchak. And from the tower, you'd be able to keep lookout. You'd be able to keep an eye on all of the surrounding villages and towns. Big Brother can be watching you from there. To make sure that in the outlying town, they're not separatists. They're not looking to break away. They're not differing from the party line. Therefore, it had to be really tall. It was the KGB, right? I mean, now we wouldn't say it had to be really tall. We would say they'd have to dig tunnels underneath to plant the listening devices, right? Or literally, as Orwell painted in 1948, he wrote 1984, about what was happening in 1948, you know, the telescreens, you know, everywhere you went. You all went to high school. Everybody read 1984, right? Certainly I did. In high school, you had to read it. Now there were the telescreens every place, watching and recording and everything that you do. The Netziv goes on, v'amnam yesh la'avin ma chashashu im yatsu kama la'aretz acheret. And therefore you can understand this idea, why it would be dangerous for somebody to leave and to go to a different place. Umuvan sheze haya shayach ledvarim achadim shaya b'neihem u'ba'asher ein deot b'nei adam shavim chashashu shelo yatsu b'nei adam midei azu yu machshav b'machshav acheret. God forbid somebody should think something else. Somebody should deviate from the party line. That's the dvarim achadim, the safa achat. And anybody that deviated from the unity of purpose, the party line, and anybody that deviated from the party line, they whack him, they kill him, like they did to Avraham Avinu. Hold that thought, we're going to come back to it. Nimtza hayu dvarim achadim shebeneihem lerotz shechlitu laharog et mi shelo yachshov ke'otam. Right? What was the dvarim achadim? What was the unity of purpose? Which in and of itself isn't a bad thing to have unity of purpose. But here, they're united with the idea that everybody has to think and believe and practice and subscribe to one party line, to one ideology. And anybody that differs from it, ki hu zeh, or thinks they can separate themselves physically or ideologically, we're going to kill them right away. That's what it is. Like they tried to do to Avraham Avinu. And that's what he says, go back to Pasuk Gimel. The Torah describes, v'nisrafa l'sreifa. They get to this valley and they decide to build the tower, but there's no natural rocks. And it's here in Yerushalayim, if you want to build a big building, let's say like Beit HaMikdash, later on, like Maarat HaMachpelah, what do? You start digging. If you dig deep enough, you don't have to dig that much, you're going to find big rock. You can quarry out rocks, and you can build tall buildings, but they didn't have that in Shinar. They had to make bricks in a furnace. So the Netziv says, Kol HaMikra Ein Bo Inyan Shirui Lahudia LeInyan HaSipur. The whole story, Migdal Bavel, 9 psukim. One of those psukim gives you the recipe for how they made the bricks. What do you need it for? Umaliim hayu lahem avanim libinyan, obanu be'etz, o asu sreifat levanim. What do I care whether they built with stone or with bricks or with wood? What do I care? Ukfar lefnei hamabul katuv vayihi bana ir. Right? The Chanoch. It says that Chanoch built a city. He was the first person to build this in Perek Dawid, I think. Right? Chanoch built the city. Torah doesn't tell you how he built the city. It doesn't tell you who his Kablan was. It doesn't tell you whether they used these kinds of workers or those kinds of workers. Why does the Torah need to spend 1 out of 9 psukim telling you the recipe for the bricks that they used to make the Migdal Bavel? Right? That they had to fire the bricks in this kiln, in this furnace. V'lo pirish mema ve'ech. Bana, previously. In other words, it's the hint that the Torah puts in from which Chazal determine, no, in other words, they had to have these fiery furnaces. And the story of Avraham Avinu, go back to the first page, right? The story of Avraham Avinu, but it's in our parsha. It's not in Lech Lecha. It's the end of Noach. Parshas Noach ends with the story of Avram Avinu, the birth of Avram Avinu. Right? What's the birth of Avram Avinu? Avram Avinu. Right? This Gemara in Avodah Zarah on page 2 just reminds us, at least according to Chazal, that Avram Avinu lives at the time of the Migdal Bavel. That Avram Avinu lives at the time of Migdal Bavel. But the end of our parashat says, Ve'lo toldo Terach, Terach holid at Avram, et Nachor ve'et Haran, v'Haran holid at Lot, v'yamat Haran al pnei Terach Aviv. Rashi tells you, what does it mean that Haran died al pnei Terach Aviv? That Haran, Avram's brother, died while their father was still alive. But then he brings the Midrash. It's such a famous Midrash that many people think it's actually in the Torah. But it's not in the Torah, it's in the Midrash, as quoted by Rashi. You know, many people, many educators get very animated by this problem. The idea that there are people, there are children who think that this story is actually written in the Chumash and not merely a Midrash. But that is the fact. It's a Midrash, it's not in the Chumash. But he tells you the story, everybody knows it. Midrash Agadah Yeshomim Sh'al Yedei Aviv Mit. Right? That Haran died, through his father, on account of his father was responsible for his death. Shekibel Terach al Avraham, b'no, lifnei Nimrod. Al Shekitet et Salamav. Right? You know the story, Avram goes, he breaks the idols. So his father, Terach, what does he do?
Complains.
He doesn't complain. He hands him over to the authorities. It's like 1984. The children rat out on the parents who are not loyal party members. V'shlicho l'kibshan ha'esh. And Nimrod throws him into the fiery furnace. V'haran yoshev v'omer b'libo. Haran, his brother, sitting there, and he's on the fence, and he says, well, you know, they're going to ask me who I'm. So if Avram comes out, I'll say I'm with him. And if he gets burnt up, I'm going to say I'm with Nimrod. Avram, it's a miracle. Avram comes out of the fiery furnace, and they say to Haran, and what's with you? Whose team are you on? So he says, obviously, I'm on. So they throw him in, but the nace doesn't happen for him because he didn't really believe. And he gets burned up. That is the Medrash. That is Avram Avinu. And the Netziv says, the story of Avram Avinu, it's kind of built in between the lines to the story of the Migdal Bavel. Right? The hint to it is through the bricks, the fiery furnace. Right? It's a society. How many bricks did they have to make? How tall was the tower? I don't know. You know, you have the famous picture. This is the famous Bruegel picture, the 16th century, the most famous rendering of it. But if you, if you go online and you just Google Tower of Babel, right, you'll find there's some very good websites. There's a pretty decent website that has like an index to all the art of the Old Testament. Right, and so you can go and you can punch in any perek, and it'll give you links to all of the classic art depicting, if there is, depicting. So if you go, you punch in, Genesis chapter 11, you'll find the story of Migdal Bavel, depicted in classic, medieval and modern art. This is the most famous. Like, that's a different kind of shear, where we, like, look at slides of all these paintings and see, like, how they painted it. But how many bricks do you think? I mean, how big is a brick? I don't know. Let's say it's like our bricks. How many bricks would you need? You'd need millions and millions and millions and millions of bricks to build a building this tall. Even to start working on the project, right, you'd need a supply of many bricks. And that's the story of the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Right, the Pirkei de, I mean, you all know the story. You don't have it on the sheet, but the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer in Perek Kaf Dalet, in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, it says that they built it so tall that after a while, it took, by the time they were building the upper levels, it would take the worker a long time to get up there, right, and bring the supply of bricks up to the top. So, I mean, you all know this. This midrash says, "Im nafal adam v'meit." If a person fell off the upper levels and died, lo hayu samim lev alav. Nobody would pay attention. "V'im nafla levena," but if a brick fell from the upper levels before it was placed, Hayu yoshvin uvochin v'omrin matay taleh acheret tachteh. They'd cry and weep and wail over this one brick that fell. And what happens? What happens? Avar Avraham ben Terach. Avram is walking by, and he sees, I guess it was like a tourist attraction, right? Like, I don't know, like now people go down to Ground Zero to see what they're doing there, what they're building there. He's walking by and he sees this. He sees there are people falling off the top levels and nobody cares. And the bricks, people are weeping and wailing over each brick. V'ra'otam bonim et ha'ir v'et ha'migdal v'kilalam b'shem Hashem, b'shem Elokim. And he curses them. He says, these people, there's something wrong with them. There's something wrong with them. If you look, if you look on page 2, the Ramban. The Ramban also tells the story. The Ramban also tells the story a little differently than Rashi. The Ramban says something about Avram Avinu. This is on the pasuk of Avram Avinu, the same pasuk that Rashi tells us the story of the Kibshon HaEsh. So the Ramban doesn't accept the story of the Kibshon HaEsh with two hands. He says, ki Avram asher nolad bekuta chalak al bat ha'amon. Avraham, or Avram, he disagreed with the party line. He disagreed with what everybody thought. Shehayu ovdim ha'shemesh. They were worshipping the sun. Avram disagreed. V'natan ha'melech. The melech, according to the Midrash, is Nimrod. When it's the Midrash, and Rashi goes like this, the Midrash tries to tie everything together. That Nimrod is the king who commissions the building of the tower. Nimrod is the king that throws Avram into the fiery furnace. Avram is there at the construction of the tower. The story of Avram Avinu, when they're there dealing with Avram Avinu, this renegade, you can hear the sounds of the clanking of the hammers because the tower is being built in the background. Right? This is the picture that the Midrash paints. Right, the Midrash wants to tie all these things together. Natan HaMelech Oto Beveta Sohar, Nimrod puts him into prison. Right, Rashi doesn't have it this way, but the Midrash has it this way, that they bring this renegade, this dangerous thinker, right? They bring him to the palace. And they lock him up, and they're, what are they doing? They're debating him, right? And we have, you know these stories of Avram's debate, trying to show the flaws of Avodah Zarah. They're debating him. They're trying to, what are they trying to do?
Convince him.
Brady, yeah, it was like Winston Smith, right? It's 1948, it's 1984, right? They take him into the...
Ramban Zambikulach.
It was similar to the Ramban. The Ramban knows what this is like, right? What is the Ramban writing this? No, after he gets to Eretz Yisrael.
Okay.
Right? In other words, the Ramban writes the Perush. I mean, it was probably based on things he had said and thought and written beforehand, but the Perush is written once he gets to Eretz Yisrael. Why does Avram leave Spain? Why does the Ramban leave Spain? Yeah, because he knows what he's talking about here. He was once there debating the Christians, right? In a debate which he can't win, right? Because it's foreordained. So he leaves Spain at the end of the 12th century to come to Eretz Yisrael. And what happens when you have a dangerous thinker? He's afraid, the king is afraid that this dangerous thinker, this renegade thinker, is going to pollute the rest of the population, that these very dangerous ideas are going to get out there. He's going to cause them to stop their idolatrous beliefs. El Eretz Kanaan. So what do you do with a dangerous thinker?
Exile them.
You exile them. So the communists had the gulag, a type of internal exile, because they had a country that was big enough that you could exile somebody, I don't know, how many, 6 or 7 time zones away, they're still under your thumb, but they're isolated, they can't hurt anybody. So what does the Ramban say? The Ramban is, I mean, it's you don't need to be Sigmund Freud to realize there's like a level of biography being worked out here. is this guy, he's got dangerous ideas, we got to get rid of him. So Nimrod exiles him. Nimrod exiles him so that he won't pollute the population. So that Avraham's going towards Eretz Yisrael, according to the Ramban, Avraham's bags were already packed. And he'd already bought his bus ticket, or his camel ticket. And he was already walking in the right direction when the tzivui comes, lech lecha me'artzecha. It's an interesting idea. It's counter to the way that we normally like recall the story, even though the psukim support it. We think, lech lecha me'artzecha. There's Avraham Avinu. He's sitting at home. He's doing whatever he's doing. And he gets the phone call. Here's the tzivui. You got to go to Canaan. Avram was already on the way, right? The Ramban emphasizes. And why was he on the way? Because he was running away from the regime of Nimrod. He was running away from the society of the Migdal Bavel.
He was running away or he was cast out.
Well, he was cast out, and as if you read, I'm going to skip it, but as if you keep reading the Ramban, not only does he realize he has to go, his father, Terach, also joins him. In other words, the father, if you merge the Midrashim, the Medrash, and the Ramban together and paint one larger story, the father, Terach, rats on his son, turns him over to the authorities. But usually it was the other way around in the totalitarian. It was the children that ratted on the parents. But here, Terach hands in Avram to the thought police. Avram survives the Kivush HaNa'esh. Terach, I'm now putting in some psychological reading here. Terach sees, what kind of society is this? And leaves with Avram. My father-in-law, Zichrono Levracha, my mother-in-law is here tonight, visiting from America. My father-in-law, Zichrono Levracha, used to have this joke that he was the founding president of the Terach Society in America. The parents, whose kids all went on Aliyah, right? Lech lecha me'artzecha mibeit avicha, right? But my wife used to like to point out that at least according to, but probably even the pshat, Terach himself does tshuva and at least is on the way. I think at least according to one medrash, Terach.
Did not one already discover God?
Well, in other words, when precisely the tzivui comes. No, did he discover God already? Yeah, that's how he got into the Kivush HaNa'esh. Yeah. But in other words, why does he have to go? He discovered Hashem, but he didn't know that he had to go to Canaan.
No, that's for sure. Right. That's what he was not about.
Right.
But as far as he was so disgusted with them, and he was seeing that they were working against God and everything, he knew already that they were not following God's teaching
to have the result. Right. So, and it's, if we read it like the Netziv, the Midrash, and the Ramban together, he believes that, but what? You're Natan Sharansky. You're a refusnik.
Yeah, well, that's
right? Now, he couldn't leave. There's a big tower with a searchlight at the perimeter. Nobody can leave. And if you think differently, or if at least you publicly think differently, we're going to lock you up. And if we can't re-educate you, and if we can't brainwash you, and if we can't, what are we going to, we're going to throw you into the fiery furnace. But what? There was a miracle. So the Ramban says, maybe it was a miracle that he came out of Kivush HaNa'esh, but you don't have to believe literally in that Midrash, says the Ramban. Maybe Nimrod just thought, if we kill him, you know, it'll be worse. It'll be, you know, like this, that idea, like if you kill him, you'll become a martyr. It'll inspire others. So the best thing to do is just to exile him. Right? So he's, somebody gives him the boot, and then he starts walking on his own 2 feet as he's going, and he, you know, and the ideas further developed. This idea of painting it, and it's interesting. In other words, the Ramban and the Netziv live in very different contexts. We did this once before in Parshat Shmot. I think it might have been the last time I was here with you. We actually also did a comparison of the Netziv and the Ramban. They're so different and they're so similar. The Netziv lives in the 19th century in Lithuania. The Ramban lives in the 12th century, in the 13th century in Spain, and then here in Israel. One's a Rishon, one's a late Achron, but yet some of the issues that disturb them are the same. The Netziv is living under a type of a totalitarian regime in Tsarist Russia. We always think that communism was a totalitarian regime, right? But and maybe that causes some type of nostalgia for whatever the communist revolution came to replace, but the people that they replaced were equally as bad, equally as authoritarian, totalitarian. The Ramban, in a different type of way, also lives in a regime that tries to, right, what was the Inquisition all about? The idea that there's one pure doctrine, and we have to be very, very cautious about anybody that disagrees with that, and we have to either forcibly convert them, or at least get them to shut up. And this idea of a totalitarian regime poisons all of society. That's the meaning of the line in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, that for a brick they would weep and wail, but for a person nobody pays attention. Because in such a society, there's such a dehumanizing component to living under that type of regime that somebody dies, you know, right? Like that's Orwell becomes an unperson, right? In other words, if you're in 1984, you know, the narrator describes that there are people that like suddenly they disappear, and the Ministry of Truth, which is really the Ministry of Propaganda, where he works, where Winston Smith works, their job was they'd then go back retroactively. I mean, now it would all be on the web. It would be even easier. They'd go back and they would literally rewrite every newspaper so that there'd be no reference to such a person. Like they don't exist. Somebody falls off the top of the building, you don't have to leave. It's like they don't exist. There's this dehumanizing component of it all. But for the brick, for the project, for the national project, that we're undertaking, that's kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. That's why when there's somebody that you can't communicate with, well, if I can't communicate with them, if they don't speak my language, they're probably a very dangerous influence. So I'm better off just bashing in their head. Xenophobia, a fear of foreigners. Somebody's going to come in with a different idea, a different way of thinking. This whole idea of Safa Achat, which Rashi reads this all very differently. Rashi's idea that Safa Achat is in and of itself a value, but in this case a value turned to evil purposes. So maybe the Netziv is saying, no, Safa Achat is no good. This is a machlokis. This is a machlokis amongst the linguists, about the degree to which language shapes the way that we think. You know, Noam Chomsky is, you know, that great lover of Zion, but if you want to talk about linguistics, Chomsky is, you know, it's hard to avoid him. So Chomsky is of the idea that, like, all language is really the same. Like, there's, like, a deep structure to all language, and Star Trek is like that. Like in the world of Star Trek, like what happens? They land on a planet they've never been to. They encounter they seek out new life and new life forms. New civilizations. How do they all speak? Well, they all speak because it's a TV show, so they all have to speak English, otherwise the plot doesn't get off the ground, right? But within the internal logic of how Star Trek works, they have something called the intergalactic translator. That if you know, we land on your planet and you speak a few sentences into this intergalactic translator, right, and it can punch out your language, because it can automatically decipher that deep structure, the Chomskyan structure. But Chomsky might not be right. There's a lot of very interesting brain research. There's a lot of very interesting brain research on the degree to which language really shapes thought. And depending upon the language you speak, it influences your patterns of thought. Chomsky thought that's not true. And if you Google this stuff, you find it. There's this professor Boroditsky, B O R O-D-I-T-S-K-Y, Lira, L-E-R-A, Boroditsky, at Stanford, who's doing this really interesting stuff. I mean, you know, a little Googling and the help of Wikipedia, you can find anything. This idea that the language you speak influences the way you think. Now, Orwell was not a Chomsky. And there's the whole idea of look, I had the flu. A couple of weeks ago, I had the flu. I was in bed for 4 days, and I reread 1984. So I just have to reveal all my cards to you. It's not that I remember everything I read in the ninth grade, but it happens that I just reread it. In the back of 1984, there's an appendix where he explains the principles of newspeak. Look, it's worth reading some things. It's worth reviewing certain things. So there's this scene there where Winston Smith is talking to, you know, there in the Ministry of Truth, and he's talking to a guy that's working on the new edition of the Dictionary of Newspeak. The idea being that they rewrote the language. And this fellow who's working on the dictionary, is what do people that work on dictionaries usually do? They're adding words. Like every year, this is like, you know, like you can find it. Every year the OED adds certain, you know, like to get your word into the OED. You know, so in the last edition of the OED, they didn't have words like blog. And now the word is there, right? It makes the cut. There are new words added all the time. But in Newspeak, there are words being eliminated all the time. So this fellow says that Newspeak, it's the only language in the world whose vocabulary gets smaller every year. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. Because if you live in a society where there's something called thought crime, so what does language do? If you get rid of a word like freedom or liberty, if you live in a culture where there's no word in your language for such concepts, it tends to discourage you from thinking about such things. And it just seems obvious that the scope of language shapes thought and shapes the society. So that, I mean, you know, everybody that writes about this, you know, talks about how propaganda works, right? The Nazis certainly use this. Hannah Arendt writes about this in her book on totalitarianism, right? This is obvious. The Nitziv isn't saying this. I don't want to put too many words in his mouth. But I think this is what he's describing. What's the problem with Dvarim Achadim? That there's only one way to think. There's only one way to speak. There's only one vessel that can contain our thought. And what happens? Avraham Avinu comes and he smashes that idol. He doesn't just smash the physical idols, he smashes this ideological idol that there's only one way to see things. And he sees things differently. And then he sets out on his journey because he's cast out by people that can't contain that way of thinking. And he begins his great project of bringing Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad to the world. That idea of Avraham Avinu, the reading of the Ramban, the reading of the Nitziv, so different than that of Rashi, makes us reevaluate our Hebrew school notions. The story of the Migdal Bavel is not the coda to the story of the Dor HaMabul. It's the preface to the story of Avraham Avinu. That's what it's doing here between the two stories. We always thought Dor HaMabul, Dor HaFloga, two bookends, right? These kinds of, mythic tales of the early history before Parshas Lech Lecha. Like the Torah gives you two chapters, two parshios for free, the background story, the prequel. But really, everything starts, I mean, Rashi's first question in Chumash is based on that notion that the stuff in the beginning is somehow introductory and we have to justify it. So I can understand why from Avraham Avinu. But when you're gracious and the Babel and all of the stories of all those generations in between, the Migdal Bavel. So the Migdal Bavel is there because you have to understand what was before the advent of Avraham Avinu. The world with which Avraham Avinu breaks. Now you have to do a lot of reading between these nine lines, these nine psukim, in order to understand that. That's what Chazal, that's what Rashi, that's what the Ramban, that's what the Netziv are doing. They're filling in the lines. But if you read it in that spirit, then you understand that the Migdal Bavel is coming not to end the story of the flood, but to open everything that's going to come from now on in, the great epic tale of Avraham Avinu.